that said it. I think it was you who were talking about we don't have a plan B for Earthlings. But Musk, he wants to colonize Mars. Inside of no time, he's going to have a million people up there, whole city or two. I can't wait. Back to you, Brian.
Well, in order to do that, as you know, I mentioned before, you first have to go ahead and develop a centrifugal force artificial gravity system, because nobody is going to be able to last that trip all the way from the Earth or even the Moon to Mars without having at least a palpable degree of gravity. I don't think they'll make it. I don't think the human body will go ahead and survive that long. 9-month trip, okay? It's going to be very difficult.
I know, but in the beginning, I mean, sooner or later, my guess is it's going to be NASA. We'll eventually send somebody to Mars. I'm not predicting SpaceX, but I'm going to predict, you know, somebody. And the earlier flights, they will not have any form of gravitational system. So you're going to have these, you know, 6-month flights to Mars. They're going to spend a year there, and then another 6 months back. And when they come back to Earth, they're going to tell everybody. You know, I heard a guy in ham radio in New York one time, this guy named Brian. He said, you know, we should really have something where we could create some kind of gravity on this flight. You know, I think that was a bad idea what we just did. Back to you, Brian.
Well, you know, it makes sense because I like that movie Mission to Mars. And what I like about it is because they have the design concept pretty much straight. You know, they have a pretty good idea of how to go ahead and do it the right way. And I just can't believe you're going to stuff 4 astronauts in a capsule for 9 months. I mean, they're going to be jelly when they get there. I can't see how they're going to do it physiologically.
Yeah, I get it. And by the way, they'll have a habitat module. You know, I've seen the designs. You know, they won't be stuck in that little capsule. There will be a habitat module that will go with them. So at least they'll have, you know, a lot more room than what you think. But yeah, you know, it's what is it? 0.3 G's on Mars. 1/3 of a little easier to get up. You know, you're going to come through the atmosphere, you're going to land, and a little easier to get up than when you get up here. You know, they can barely stand. They're usually carried out of the spacecraft if they've been up there for 6 months. You'll have a little bit better chance of doing that on Mars, but not much. You know, you won't have anybody there to help you, especially in the beginning. But yeah, that's going to be a big problem. We'll see. Hope we're all around to see these landings. Anyway, thanks for your input, Brian, and everybody else that listened, and Charlie out there. But I think we're close here now. Okay, fine. I just want to see if, there's nothing else. I have a few things on the list, but we can cover them next week. Next week's going to be tough. So next Sunday will be field day will end at 2 p.m., and then we'll be on the radio at night. That should be interesting. Anyway, thanks for everybody that listened. We'll turn it over to Roy. Tomorrow night is Monday night, so that's Limark InfoNet, followed by the shopping, the was a shop and flop, flop and shop, with George, and then followed by Radio Newsline. Right now, we're going to turn back to AC2GS. This is WS2N for the space deck. Report for the tech net. Back to work.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all you do. You do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. I hope you had a fun time. I hope your blood pressure didn't rise too much by what anyone might have said. It's all good conversation. You know, take it the way it's offered. And I hope you'll join us all next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. I hope you have a great field day. Next weekend is going to be field day, so have loads and loads of fun. And as always, let me remind you of some clever quotes. Dick, K2RIW, would always end his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other. And that's always good advice. And good old Epictetus had his, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas, and don't keep them so wide open that your brain falls out, because then they'll get dirty and dusty, and that's not good for anyone's brain. So, once again, everyone, have a great week. Stay safe. Stay cool. It's going to be a real hot week this week. So air conditioners were given to us as a gift from God, so take advantage of it. But don't use too much energy, electricity, or else we're going to have problems with electrical supply. Anyway, have a great week. Stay safe. Be well. And as always, IAC2GS will be clear after I say, Slava Ukraini.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Roy, and everyone else participating. This is KF2ZZ, Brian, clearing the frequency and wishing everyone a nice, cool week and a good evening. Thank you.
Good night, guys.
That was a fascinating net. Definitely glad that I clicked on the button to join. It was just really interesting. I think 3 hours, I think we had.
Okay, 73, guys. Yeah. Brian, I'm just looking at the maximum payload. Yeah, I said 35,000. It looks like 41,570 pounds. The low Earth orbit. Anyway, that's with all the boosters. 73, guys, WS20.
Okay, well, have a good night. Thank you very much again. 73.
N2IBS. Roy, what field day are you going to go to, if at all?
I tend to misbehave when it comes to field day. I know it's a terrible thing to admit to fellow hams. To me, it's camping with radios. I never liked camping, so I don't really frequent it. I like the the comfort of my home shack with air conditioning and no mosquitoes, and it never floods. So there's a lot of positive aspects to a home-based operation as opposed to out in the open in camping-wise.
That's fair, yeah. Fort Bennett Field is it's a place that it has some good qualities and many bad qualities, but I don't know, I like to go because it's going to give me an opportunity outside of being in Pittsburgh to operate on HF. And since I live in an apartment in Manhattan, I can't really put a huge inverted V up or anything, so it's a nice opportunity to get some DW practice on 40 meters or 60 meters, something like that.
Yeah, sure, I completely understand. If you don't mind the mosquitoes and the flooding and such, it certainly is an opportunity to give you more experience. You know, thankfully, I have a two-family private house here when I can cajole some fellow hams to help me out to hoist some antennas. I have some decent antennas to do HF by myself. So, again, it doesn't scratch any itch for me at this point. So, you know, maybe I'll change my mind in some future. I find that actually, unfortunately, I grow a little bit lazy year after year.
I see. Well, hopefully we'll still hear you over the airwaves or something. I'm sure you'll be around. And if not, I will be back here in 7 days' time at 8 p.m. for the next week.
Very good. Yeah, I hope you'll join us. I'll be on 10 meters Sunday morning. I do it most Sunday mornings at 11 to 1 o'clock, and usually Max makes a point of getting one of the radios set up for 10 meters on Sunday morning. So if you're around on the in field day area on a Sunday morning, you'll most likely hear me.
All righty. Yep. It's looking like I'm going to be one of the people working the overnight shift, so I'll certainly be there in the morning on Sunday, because I'll be there to pack it all down. So I'll be there for that night.
Very good. Yeah, it's always a pleasure to hear that we've gotten some new members who want to get involved in things. We have a significantly large number of members that I haven't seen in 10 years. They send in their checks. So that's about all they do these days. It's kind of surprising. Well, it was surprising to me, but I've grown used to it. You know, we have about 71, 72 members, but more than half of them, you know, you don't hear them on any of the nets. They don't come for any of the events. But at least they pay dues. We could always use the money.
Yeah, that's true. Money is always useful, but it's nice to see that there's some also younger members, although I'm pretty sure currently I'm the youngest member. But, you know, trying to just see new people get involved in ham radio is always a good thing, given the aging population in the hobby. But I don't know, at my university it's actually growing at Carnegie Mellon. We have our club is, I think we gained like 10 or 12 new members more than usual this year. I mean, it's been a huge year for the club. I don't know how it is here though.
Well, I mean, when I joined the club 14 years ago, and 14 years ago there were kind of six guys who showed up every month. The youngest one was, I think, about 48, 49, and went up to about 70. And over the years, especially since we kind of put some effort into the website, so a lot of, I think, young people do a Google search, and if you do a Google search for amateur radio clubs in New York City, we come up rather either the first or the second. I think we've attracted more younger, and not the kids. I understand why some people really like to get kids involved. You know, I find kids to be a big variable. Often when they discover girls, they disappear. You have them kind of pop out of existence in high school, and then they come back when they send their kids off to college. So I kind of see, you know, 30 and 40-year-olds is kind of the optimum new member, where they're not going to discover anything that distracts them anytime too soon.
Yeah, that's fair. I personally got into the hobby because I'm an electrical engineering student, so when you want to go design antennas and do RF for a living, you know, ham radio is a really fun hobby because, you know, it's a practical application of it, and you don't need to spend $1 million. It's a really fun hobby. Yeah. I know a lot. Most our club is mostly electrical engineering students who are in that same boat. We all discovered it at college, pretty much. I don't think most anybody has done ham radio prior, but yeah, it seems to be a growing thing. A lot of people they're putting down video games, it seems, and trying to find better hobbies for their for longevity, and that won't slot in their brain.
AC2GS, it's the intellectual curiosity. You could be great at games and not be intellectually curious because you don't really think about why things are the way they are. They're just written that way. So, yeah, we have a couple of electrical engineers in addition to yourself. In the old days, the kind of route to amateur radio operating were either shortwave listeners, which were much popular back in the before the internet, where countries only had one route for their propaganda, that was shortwave. And you could also listen to hams on the side as well. And then other guys who got into it by Citizens Band, and a bunch of people who kind of got through the Army as part of the Signal Corps. More of all those three than there were electrical engineers, but there's always electrical engineers. The gentleman who used to run this technical net, Dick Nadel, K2RIW, was an electrical engineer, Pace University he went to. So unfortunately, those guys kind of were here because a lot of the heavy electrical defense industry was on Long Island, and they moved to the West Coast. So those guys are just fading away, or they moved away.
I know a lot of our alumni end up on the West Coast, and there's a significant outpost of my university's club that exists over there, mostly in Southern California nowadays. A lot of them went to go work at Elon's companies or similar, and Apple, a lot of them as well, so most of them start out on the East Coast, born and raised on the East Coast, but then all the jobs are over there, so you don't have a choice. I'm hoping I can stay on the East Coast, but, you know, it's entirely up to the job market, so I have to make a living somehow, and to do IBM.
Yeah, I understand completely. I mean, again, for a sundry bunch of reasons, the defense industry was clustered on Long Island. So there were big amateur radio clubs, and there were large groups of amateur radio engineers who could build their own damn radios. You know, nowadays we have guys who complain to me that they bought their radio with their own credit card, and how dare someone call them an amateur.
Yeah, building your own radio is it's a different beast. We have a couple people in our club who are some of the master's students and PhDs who've done that. I personally think it's a little bit of wizardry. I'm not quite far enough along in the program to really fully understand the entirety of how to build a radio from scratch with just kind of a project circuit board and a soldering iron like some of these people are doing. But I respect it very much. And, you know, maybe one day, it's always been something I've wanted to do, is to be able to have all my own stuff and not have to rely on, oh, well, I need this one feature to release and nobody has it. It'd be nice to just make it on my own, but, you know, that's a ways away.
Yeah, it's good to aspire to that, even though you may never quite reach it. You could build little gadgets, too. There's a lot of things that are simpler than a radio, but almost as useful. I have this lovely little digital watt meter by a guy named Larry Phipps called the LP500. And beautiful stuff. I mean, it took him time. I was on a waiting list for a couple of years, and in the middle of his finalizing the design, the manufacturer of one of his important chips took them out of production. So he had to redesign the whole board.
Oh gosh, yeah, that's not good. Yeah, when they take the chips out of production, especially on a project he worked for that long on, I can't imagine how disappointing that must have been. I mean, that's no good. But yeah, but that's always what I fear when I think about starting large projects like that. It's a lot of these companies, they're so profit driven, and kind of fluid with their offerings that you can't really bet on one singular ship, even if it seems like it'll be there. You can't really bet on it being there 2, 3, 4, 5 years. So if anything breaks and you can't get a replacement, it's really a tough situation.
Yeah, it's always a good practice to go with the most generic chips that are around. Like, yeah, I don't know what Century 555 chips will cease to be produced by someone. But I think in his case, the chip that was important was the dot matrix for the LCD display. So you can't kind of, there's no such thing as a generic LCD driver.
No, yeah, I mean, LCD drivers are a huge pain as is, but obviously you found a workaround, but given that you have it, but yeah, that might have required a change of LCD display. Yeah, messing with drivers and those things is a slippery slope. It gets really, really annoying really fast because it's just the little ways, just with different architectures that you design a ship based on. One little change can result in an entirely different end behavior on every single part of the ship, even if it's like, you know, just switch from one type of resistor to another, even if the functionality should be the same. The voltage required might be slightly different, and the fluctuation, it might not pass from one ship to another.
AC2GS. Yeah, it turned out to be a positive in some ways, because he settled upon a higher resolution chipset. So the image was much nicer, and it gave him time to pause and consider for the somewhat geriatric audience to offer two sizes. So he offered a 5-inch diagonal LCD screen and also a 7-inch for people with a little bit off visual acuity. So it turned out to be a positive. I mean, it set him back a year and a half, which was a pain in the backside, but it turned out all for the best.
Yeah, NGYWS. Yeah, I mean, yeah, stuff like that. Definitely having a break lets you consider more the longevity of the product, and I'm sure that adding that 7-inch screen did wonders for the lifespan of that product. I mean, a 5-inch screen is pretty small, but 7 inches, you know, you don't need reading glasses for that. Yeah, well, some people might, but it's less likely to need reading glasses for it. So it should be a little easier to use, and that means people are going to be happier with the product. So I think it probably ends up benefiting them pretty well. So I agree.
Yeah, I mean, the only problem is he's so successful. It's a mom-and-pop's shop, so I think he assembles them himself. So since he's assembling them day in and day out, he has no time to upgrade the firmware that he promised he'd upgrade 8 years ago. So that's the only downside.
Oh, yeah, I'm surprised things haven't started to break given that the firmware hasn't been updated in 8 years. Although, there's a lot of fan radio software that I don't think has been updated in more than 8 years. It still somehow works, so I'll give it that. Hams are very good at making long, long-lasting software.
Well, it's pretty much self-contained. So since it doesn't, I mean, it has an output where it has a virtual window, but it's a very vanilla virtual window. You can't scale it. That was one of the things he promised down the road. So, you know, in and of itself, there's nothing inherent in the watt meter that changes. No one upgrades the operating system for the watt meter, so you don't have to worry that upgrades are going to break something. It's self-contained, so, you know, it's not probably that likely that something will break, as opposed to a feature that needs to be implemented someday, he never gets around to it.
Got it. Yeah. I don't know. I personally, I'm still not entirely convinced with the digital watt meters and stuff. I'm more of an analog guy. Something about the analog meters, I trust them more. That could just be me being used to analog test equipment, just because that's what I had throughout all of high school when I was tinkering with electronics. But I don't know. I like the idea of digital meters and stuff. I just use not as much time on them.
Well, yeah, but since it's digital, it's capable of a lot of nice, interesting things. It can display the average power and the peak envelope power, and it even can do Lissajou figures and linearity. Geez, I'm blocking on what the hell it's called. Trapezoid displays to see the linearity of my linear amplifier versus my driver. So it has a bunch of nice little color, features on it that I like.
Oh yeah, that sounds nice. Yeah, some of that stuff is. Yeah, that's definitely the benefit of digital, is that you can actually extract data from it. Analog, not so much. You can just see, oh, it's 100 watts, or oh, it's not 100 watts, kind of thing. Definitely, the digital lets you get a lot more consistent. And know a lot more about what's happening beyond just what you can see instantaneously. I don't know. It sounds like an interesting thing to have. I just never used it in the rig. Our rig just, because our club is 110 years and change old now. Most of our equipment is analog, save for, we just got a new computer. And DX Engineering was nice enough to give us an ICOM IP7300, but like most of our power stuff is all still analog.
Oh, okay. I mean, there's a lot of stations like that. I got my license.
Roy, you still there? Sound like you cut out.
Yeah, let me see if I'm still there. Yeah, I fell out of All-Star. It does that occasionally, unfortunately. I've had my license for 14 years, and I tend to buy new stuff. So most of my stuff is, certainly I don't have any vacuum tube-based stuff. My linear amplifier is solid state. I do have, for sentimental reasons, I have a Bird watt meter sitting less than a foot away from my digital watt meter, for old time's sake.
Nice. Yeah, for my personal rig, I'm still looking to get a main-gen receiver. Hoping Field Day, I'll just try out a couple and try and land closer to one final decision, because I'm kind of between a few models right now. I'm not sure entirely if I want all bands or if I want to do a separate UHF along with a HF space transceiver. I'm just not entirely sure.
Yeah, that's a big question people have, whether they should get an all-in-one or whether they should get, a decent UHF EHF and then a decent HF radio. I pretty much have kind of both. I have an ICOM 7100, which is an all-in-one. My Flex 6700 is theoretically an HF radio, but I have it tricked out to do 70 centimeters and 2 meters as well.
Oh, that's interesting. How'd you get it to do 70 and 2?
Well, the 6700 has a milliwatt output on 2 meters, so it's not terribly useful, but if you find a high-gain, low-noise amplifier and preamp, you can operate on 2 meters, and for 70 centimeters, I just use the transverter.
Oh, that's pretty simple, yeah. Got it. Yeah, I'm still, with UHF and VHF, because I spend so much of my time in Pittsburgh on the campus, which is not, because we have a repeater that we use on campus, and it's just right kind of in the center campus. So I'm not entirely sure if I even need a UHF, VHF mobile for most of the year, and I'm probably going to be checking into most of the nets via Echolink because I'm in Pittsburgh anyway. So I'm kind of thinking that I might actually just go with the HF or 50 megahertz kind of transceiver, because I feel like that's what I end up wanting to use more, especially since I want to try some contesting and stuff.
Yeah, sure, that sounds like a plan. I mean, there's 100 different routes in this hobby, And almost everyone picks a slightly different random one. You know, whichever best for you. It's good if you have the opportunity to play around with other guys' rigs and get a feel for it, what it sounds like, what the signal reception is like. In the old days, I think people actually would go to stores, but I don't think most of the store radios are hooked up these days. They're just kind of just pretty models and such. So, you know, the more people you know, the more opportunity do you have to test things out. You know, the ICOM 7300 seems to have been the radio to buy for the last 7-8 years. Usually every 10 years, one radio has a really nice price point. So I think it's at the end of the ICOM 7300 being the radio of the decade, and haven't quite figured out what the next one's going to be.
Yeah, he actually went to DS Engineering physical location, which is like in a parts superstore, which is an interesting in itself. But they're the only retailer that I've been to that has hooked up physically to antenna. Their radios are all hooked up. But since I've been back, I mainly just go to Advanced Specialties out in Long Beach, and their stuff isn't hooked up, so I'm not really. I can't touch, but I have Gen Beavers like, on display. In terms of what the next it radio is, honestly, it's looking like the new FPS-1 from J2 might be one of the possible candidates for that spot. I mean, it really kind of does it all, and it's good in such a compact package, and the price point on it is just... It's at a great price, around $1,000 for an all-band, all-mode, and you can kind of configure it how you want. That's what I see as kind of possibly being the next big one, but I'm not really sure.
AC2GS, yeah, you don't know until it pops into popularity, because, you know, a lot of radios have initial buzz, and then the initial buzz fades away. The way I've tracked it is about 25 years ago, it was the ICOM, I think it was 704 or something. Then it was the Kenwood TS-2000, and then it was the ICOM 7300. So I don't remember a time of my reckoning where Yaesu was the go-to. Yaesu's, they had kind of two schizophrenic lives. They have very small, relatively inexpensive, with a lot of controls bunched up and sort of difficult to figure out. And then you have the big, pretty ones that they've been pumping out for the last 6-7 years. So they never made it as big as ICOM has, at least as far as I'm aware, talking to people on the bands and such. It's weird. You go on the hotspot, and you invariably bump into all these guys who all have the same any tone handy talkie, and then you have, like I said, for 7-8 years, 3/4 of the people I bump into on the HF bands have an ICOM 7300. And before that, again, it was the Kenwood TS-2000. Wesley that you might have heard at the tail end of the technical net. He has two TS-2000s, and a good friend of his and mine, when he passed away, they did inventory. The guy had five TS-2000s.
I don't know. If you do it in five of them, I guess you can have one for every band you want to do, but I know before the 7300, our main transceiver was a TS-2000 over in Pittsburgh, and I know a lot of the lumps were about that thing being one of the greatest radios they've ever used. We'll probably hook it up again, given that we have so many more members. We kind of need to set up in a second operating station. That's probably one of the projects that I'm going to undertake when I get back in mid-August, actually.
Yeah, it's still a respected radio, so if you have one around, you should pull them out and play around with them. I'm sure you'll get some pleasure out of that.
The only downside is that I can think of is really that it just doesn't have the Texan stuff on it. Otherwise, I don't really see any reason not to just have it hooked up as a second space station.
Yeah, I agree. If you got it, use it. I mean, sometimes there are guys who kind of do it to the degree of absurdity. I know a guy who's really into radios that were made in the 50s. And so this guy has a stack of different models, different brands, different degree of being broken, and he has an uncontrollable desire to rotate them. He did a 2 meter FM, not 2 meter AM net, and he would rotate his radios capable of 2 meter AM, whether they worked or not. I don't know. I think it was an obsession on his part.
Yeah, that's next level. And that stuff is pretty heavy, too. All that stuff in the 50s is hard to move around. So I'll give them credit. That takes a lot of dedication.
Yeah, or obsession. I had a good friend, unfortunately, he became a silent key. He got himself an old, I think it started life as a broadcast AM transmitter, and it got retrofitted for the ham bands. And he had it somehow hoisted up to his attic. I don't know if he ever, unfortunately, had a chance to play with it much, but I mean, the idea of a massive broadcast AM transmitter being hoisted up to an attic struck me as a Herculean task.
Yeah, and just a correction earlier, I said we had a 7300. That was our old one. Our new one that we got from DX Engineering for the low, low price of free is a 7610, and that thing has been absolutely wonderful, albeit I would never buy it with my own money because it is like 3,000 and change.
Yeah, well, ICOM sells more expensive radios. We used to have a gentleman on this repeater who liked to impress people that he had a lot of money. He would discuss that he had to go down to the Mercedes dealership and pick up a cherry red lease car for his wife, and how he was going to a vacation in some tropical island and do some DXing and such. And the way he described his most recent ICOM purchase, he didn't even know the model number. He said, you know, the most expensive ICOM that they sell, the one with the little gold trim thing. So he was kind of the exception to the rule. Most amateur radio operators kind of want to save their money, or at least don't brag about it as much as this guy did.
Yeah, I don't quite get bragging about that stuff if you're not making the contact in the stuff to back it. I mean, the only time I've seen that is that most expensive model with the gold trim has been at that business, like, really big contesting station that always wins the global DX competitions over, like, the border of Pennsylvania and Ohio. We visited that station. They have a bunch of, like, aerials that are tall enough that they got to paint them white and red, and they have a bunch of those. I think they have the, like, something like six or more stations for when they do their big contesting, but I don't know. I don't get why you would spend all that money on something like that. I mean, at the end of the day, the 7300 is everything that you needed to do. Minus a couple convenience buttons, like jumping to different bands and hot fuse, but I don't really see a reason to buy one of those top-of-the-line radios, honestly.
Some people just like the bragging rights, and if they have enough money to waste on, are you familiar with a company called Hilberling?
I'm not sure I'm familiar with it. If you could just give me the quick rundown and do idea.
Yeah, it's a German company. They have these big heavy. They're built like tanks. They're probably very good. Their specs seem to look good, but they're still ridiculously expensive. I think their transceiver goes for close to $20,000.
Oh, my God. What?
Yeah, I don't know if it's bragging rights or... I mean, I'm sure it's a fine radio, but, you know, there's only so much I could kind of understand of spending for a radio. Yeah, a couple of years ago, Yaesu went a little crazy internally and decided to try and sell overpriced items. They came out with a $500 microphone. That had two elements that were switchable, and it had gold trim on it. It was a lot of bling for a lot of money for not really any reason. I doubt that they sold too many of them. I haven't seen them advertised in years.
Oh, I bet one guy bought it. Mr. Mercedes himself most likely has one of those sitting around. Might not even have a radio worth it, but I'm sure he bought it.
It's possible, but I don't think he would be enchanted with I don't think $500 was expensive enough for a microphone. He probably had a broadcast. You know, some of those radio broadcast microphones go for $2,000.
Oh, yeah. I'm in, I do live event production as well on the side. And yeah, $2,000 is a price that I've seen on some microphones. Some of them get way above that. Once you get into the world of professional audio, it starts to be a bonfire of $100 bills.
Well, that's always the case of anything commercial. You know, prosumer was a way to rip off the consumer by suggesting that at half the price of a professional equipment, it's almost as good as the professional stuff. And, you know, professionals always kind of take a tax deduction. So they, on one level, they don't care what the price of the things are.
Yep. Yeah, I agree with the prosumer being just kind of a scam. It's a combination of tax deductions, and also it's not my money that I'm spending. That's also a big part of why we're willing to spend, $100,000 on some speakers. What is the inventory we have? You know, it's very different if it's not your money and you're making money from it. Prosumer, that's not generating any income, and it's not built to last the same way professional gear is either.
AC2GS. Yeah, well, as I've grown older and older, I've come to the conclusion that about 98% of everything is a bit of a grift. Nothing is 100% legitimate. You know, if you listened earlier to Jim, he had a problem that a government never did anything perfectly good. Well, human beings never do anything perfectly good. It's just the fallibility of our species.
Yep, totally agreed. I think perfection is an impossibility. I don't believe that anything can be perfect, including our own species. I think that we're inherently imperfect, and that's just how it is. And you know, nothing wrong with that. Just always have to be skeptical, because things are not always as they seem, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, every so often when I'm in a weird mood, I'll put a little Persian floor into something that won't cause anyone any problem, just to see if anyone notices.
I see. And through IBS, yeah. And I suspect that more often than not, I should say, the answer is they don't.
Oh, yeah, they don't at all. I've done so many different weird permutations with the newsletter. I once explained to people at the beginning that we were including a original work in its original form in the last page. And what I did was made a copy of the first page of the Iliad in the original Greek. No one mentioned it.
Speaking of the news, sir, I don't think I'm receiving it. I'm not entirely sure if I'm listed as an official member yet either. I know I paid my dues, so I'm not entirely sure what's going on there, but... Yeah, if you could just let me know how to get on the newsletter mailing list, that'd be good.
Yeah, you're on the newsletter mailing list. You joined the club something like 2 weeks ago, and we send it out once a month. When I finally get around to transcribing the minutes and putting it together, so sometime this week you'll get a copy of the newsletter.
Okay, just wanted to make sure that I wasn't screwing anything up or anything or missed it. Thanks for the confirmation.
No problem. A matter of fact, if you go to the website and you click on the menu that says members, you should find yourself there.
Oh, I'll go check that right now. I haven't been added yet, but I'm sure that'll come in due time. I'm not too concerned. By the way, is there a ton of cross-pollination between KCRC and Limar? I feel like a lot of people are coming, saying they were coming in from Brooklyn or similar areas. I'm just curious how much similarities in the members there are on the different nets and such.
Limar's probably the biggest local club. It has about 350 members. When I first joined, it had about 400 and change. So there's some crossover. There's not a great deal of crossover. I'd say there's maybe about 8 or 9 people who are members of both clubs out of 72.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Less than I expected. It's interesting because coming from Manhattan, I find that it's actually much easier for me to get the Limar repeater than it is to get the KCRC repeater, even though that seems somewhat backwards, given the distance. I've never actually been able to get the KCRC repeater from my apartment, but I'm pretty consistently getting the Limar one. Not entirely sure why that is.
Yeah, well, you know, antennas work in mysterious ways. Ours is omnidirectional. Limar uses a quad-folded dipole, so they could maneuver the radiation pattern favoring any particular place that they'd like. Every so often, I comment on the TechNet and other places how they're really not really directing anything towards this end of Brooklyn, which is why I'm stuck with All-Star. And they keep on telling me it's not the location of the dipoles, it's just the apartment complexes between the... Testing 1, 2, 3. Yep, I'm back. I tell Adam All-Star again, Ben.
Yeah, I put that in the chat on EchoLink, not knowing if it's synced over to your side or not. But yeah, All-Star seems to have dropped out again. But you're back.
Benjamin, I keep on pulling out of All-Star. I think the repeater is tired of me. It's been nice talking to you. I look forward to our next conversation. I'm sure either on the other repeater, if you're ever able to get into it, This is Echo Link works as well there. And certainly I hope you join us again on the technical net here.
Yep. Great talking to you, Chris Wellroy, 7-3, and I'll see you on the TechNet next week, if not before that. Have a good night.
You too, 73. This is AC2GS, and I am once again clear.
This is N2YPS, and I am also clear.
Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
A2TS Mobile.